right, we welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals this morning. We have two cases set on our 10:30 docket and then some cases set later in the afternoon. We will hear the first two cases, the first one being in the interest of JBMB, cause number 2-15040CV, and then we'll go directly into Cox versus State after that. I understand counsel have checked in. If the clerk will please announce who's arguing for us today. All right, Mr. Wade.
May it please the court. It's a privilege and an honor to appear before you today. This is my second oral argument in the last 10 years of my private practice, if you will. So these don't come very often. And I know where it may be a little bit repetitious for you, it's always a privilege for somebody like myself to appear before three judges, not just one trial judge. Having said that to you, let me explain, having read your local rules, I'm not here to read my brief. I want to get that clearly out of the way. So if I cite to the appellant's brief, I hope you understand that I'm not doing so simply to read it, but to point out to you where the devil may be in the details. First and foremost, as this esteemed panel knows, the law abhors default judgments. The law is meant to render verdicts, decisions, if you will, based on the substance, the substantive evidence in a case, as well as the applicable law to that evidence. Unfortunately, this case arises out of a default judgment, and unfortunately, judges have to balance when keeping a case moving forward versus rendering a quote-unquote default judgment. And between you and I, if you will, and since you don't know me, my practice is throughout North Texas, here in the trial courts of Tarrant County, including criminal and family, as well as the trial courts in Dallas, that evil 214 jurisdiction, which I'm fully reminded of occasionally from some of your colleagues downstairs, and as well as Collin County and Denton County, if you will, and a few other jurisdictions thrown in for good measure. And I find this to be an extremely common mistake being made by your brethren, if you will, and sistren, at the trial court level. In this case, I'd like to point out to you something in the supplemental record, which is of paramount to our argument in order to provide Mr. Burke his day in court. And I would like to point out to the court that if you're taking time to be here and grant oral argument, certainly my client needed to take time and be here to show his respect for your time and your position, if you will, within the jurisdiction, within the system, and he is here for the record. Now, there is an affidavit of service on page 5 in this case of the clerk's supplemental record, and I know you know the law. I'm here to hopefully answer any questions you may have, as well as point out the details in the record to show why this case should be reversed and remanded to the trial court. This affidavit of service does not reference anything other than a citation. And service of a citation alone obviously is legally insufficient to put any party in any type of a case, on the civil side, of course, on notice of what they are being hauled into court for or what they need to answer in court for. Ironically, you have as part of your record in this case the final decree that was rendered also between Mr. Burke and his ex-wife, wherein the child support order signed by Judge Bailey in that case, the parents had agreed, and the judge affirmed that agreement, where they would split the expenses more or less 50-50. And the appellee in this case suggests to you that that's not a child support agreement. I would suggest to you it is a child support agreement. Does it deviate from the guidelines set forth in the Texas Family Code? Well, of course it does. But are parents allowed to enter agreements that do deviate from the guidelines, if you will? And my argument to you is, yes, we allow parents who are supposedly in the best position to know what's in the best interest of their own children to enter into agreements, as long as it's not against the law, as well as truly against public policy per se. And I'll remind you that two consenting adults and one sitting district judge in Denton County approved that agreement. So there was a child support agreement in this case. Going back to the supplemental clerk's record on page 5, the affidavit of service, the question is in the second paragraph where it says that the affiant, the service process server, said, I received a citation. Well, she doesn't indicate, if you will, or he doesn't indicate, whether or not a petition was attached to that. And ultimately, if you look in the third paragraph, where the affiant for the affidavit of service admits or states, I attempted to deliver the documents to the above address. That, of course, begs the question, what documents? So, in order for the appellant to meet his burden of proof and have this court reverse a case and remand, the error must be clear on the face of the record. Well, obviously, the clerk's supplemental record is part of the record, and that in and of itself is dispositive of this appeal, if you will. If you don't think that's dispositive of this appeal, I would address your attention to what the Texas Supreme Court has laid out for the lower courts in the state to follow is strict compliance. Now, Mr. Flynn, if you will, on behalf of the appellee, attempts to somehow split a hair here between the difference between literal compliance and strict compliance. As silly as I feel reciting law to the three of you, if you will, I can only suggest to you that the Texas Supreme Court, for I believe the term is well over a century, citing Primate Construction versus Silver, has said that proper service not being affirmatively shown, there is error on the face of the record, and a court of appeals in that case erred in holding otherwise. Ultimately, if you will, what you get in Primate also is the fact that there must be strict compliance, which is the standard, strict compliance. And there is no presumption of proper service. There is no legal presumption of proper service. And regrettably, trial courts make these mistakes fairly often, if you will, in failing to look at what the returns of service actually dictates. And as you know, we live in an age of printable forms and fill-in-the-blank type matters. And is it fair, and I hesitate to use that word in a courtroom being an adult and the parent of two grown children, but is it appropriate to hold this process server to a higher standard or to that of even as a lawyer? And the answer is yes. Because really what's at play here, as you know, is due process, one of the two fundamental cornerstones of obviously our legal system, the other being, of course, equal protection.
And let me ask a question. Was this regular service as opposed to any kind of substituted service that had required a court order?
Yes, Madam Chief Justice, and I appreciate the opportunity to address that with you. So this was just normal service without any substituted service, I think, pursuant to rule TRCP Rule 106, if you will. And unfortunately, if you will, the affidavit of service fails to properly demonstrate and prove conclusively what was actually served when you use the term, I received a citation and I served documents. We have no idea.
But does it say documents attached here too, or it incorporates some documents? Your point is we just don't know which documents.
Actually, it says on in the third paragraph of that clerk's supplemental clerk's record if you will, that I attempted to deliver the documents. And what Appellee will argue, obviously, which was in their brief, as well as I assume or during oral argument, that it says a motion to modify. It was an amended motion to modify. In the clerk's record, if you will, there was originally an original petition to reopen the suit to modify. But the second motion, the second live pleading was an amended motion, not a petition. It could be done, I think, either way, but the first pleading was referred to as petition. The second pleading was referred to as an amended motion. And consequently,
let me ask you a question, too. On the citation under the column document.
Yes, Your Honor.
It says amended motion to modify and notice of hearing. Were those two separate documents, or was that all incorporated in one document?
Excuse me. Well, that's the problem with the record in this case. We don't know. And, of course, I can't present to you anything outside of the record. And so on the face of the record, what you have is complete vagueness and ambiguity because we don't know what documents were actually served. We just know that the clerk, the process server, was in possession of a citation. Now, sure, I don't want to sit up here and deny that the sun rises in the east, sets in the west, and that obviously this side of the Trinity is heaven, and the other side of the Trinity may not be quite as heavenly. But the fact of the matter is that this court, nor can a district trial court, assume or fill in the blanks with what was in fact served. So that is why I think, obviously, the Texas Supreme Court for the last 100 years, citing Primate and its progeny, has said strict compliance with the rules of service of process must be adhered to. Without that, none of us know what was actually served upon any party, if you will. I hope I answered your question.
Well, I was actually asking that, you know, the document itself, the amended motion to modify, that document.
Yes, Your Honor.
Sometimes there's a motion and then there's a separate order setting hearing or notice of hearing. But sometimes in the document itself, the notice of hearing is, you know, appears below the motion itself, and is really a part of that document. Are you saying the record is silent as to which way it is?
Yes.
In this case, there's nothing in the record.
There's nothing in this record, including the clerk's record, and
to tell us whether that was one document or two documents,
or whether or not those documents were even served.
Well, I know, I get that part. I get the part that it says the documents, and we don't know what that is.
Yes.
But my question really is more, when in the citation itself, when it refers to the amended motion and the notice of hearing, is that one is that one document or is that two documents? In the record, and you're saying in the record, it's we don't know.
I would suggest to you that in the record, if you will, the amended motion and the notice of hearing, I believe, are all one document.
Okay.
Okay, citing
that was
in
my
the
question.
Record. And, of course, if I misstate something to you, I apologize, but I want to plead.
We'll find it if you
yes,
do.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm sure they will find it too. Also, the fact is, as I am paper challenged, and it, you know, they said we were going to have less paper in the future some time ago, and it just doesn't seem to be working out that way. So I want to apologize to you profusely ahead of time if I misstate something, and it would be completely unintentional.
Let me ask another question. It looks like there were events and settings taking place throughout and through the course of the next 12 or 13, 14 months.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so I just want to clarify that your client did not enter an appearance at any of those hearings or responsive to any of the discovery that was sent to him. Is that correct?
That I was not attorney of record at that time. For the record in this case, our appearance came, I believe, in December of 2014, if you will, when Mr. Burke was ultimately arrested, if you will, on a outstanding capias for the motion to show, or the notice to show cause, why he didn't appear beforehand. And so what I would suggest to you is this, is that obviously being arrested does not make a general appearance, if you will. That issue seemed to be not come up in our brief, and it's neither is that issue in Appley's brief, and this is where I feel like I'm on really thin ground, is suggesting to this appellate court that if that wasn't brought up, then that point of error would be waived, as I understand appellate procedure. And please take into account I went to remedial law school when I say that to you. As you can tell, I don't take myself too seriously. I take my client's case with the utmost seriousness. hope that's okay with the court. Issue number two in this case, if you will, is that there is a complete lack of proper substantive pleading in the amended motion of appellee to invoke the trial court's jurisdiction. And I see this all the time in my family law practice, and most people say, well, one of the parties had a change in circumstances. They either lost their job or the other party got a pay raise. So we're going to run back to court and either try to lower or raise child support. The fact of the matter is that Texas law requires a historical basis in order to change or modify child support, meaning you must show the position of that party that is going to be the subject to the change prior to or when the original support order, the previous support order, was actually entered, as well as then a material and substantial change, and then what that new change is. Ironically, in this case, Judge Bailey, who did findings of fact and conclusions of law, which I will direct this court to, I believe is in the index, or excuse me, the regular, the first record, not the supplemental, on page 89. If you will look at his findings of fact and conclusions of law, he never found any material or substantial change. That is a problem, and I find in family courts, as you know, they obviously are courts of continuing jurisdiction, but they are not, that's in personam jurisdiction. It can be substantive jurisdiction or subject matter jurisdiction, but that's what the whole purpose of having a material and substantial change is to re-engage the jurisdiction of a trial court.
Mr. Wide, we've gone over time a little bit now already, but you will have your five-minute rebuttal that you did ask for. Thank you. And for Mr. Flynn, if the clerk will please add 1 minute of time, should we need that? So that we stay fairly evenly distributed in time. Thank you, Mr. Wide. Mr. Flynn.
Thank you, Justice. And this is the first time that I've ever argued an appeal. I'm not even a very experienced lawyer. I don't know what you all know, but I've only been a lawyer for a few years now. So this is kind of a new experience. There were four issues raised by appellant in his original brief. It sounds like he chooses to argue two of them rather than all four today. So I'm going to limit my argument at this point, absent questions, to the two major issues. And by the way, there was one document somewhere in this. Motion was named the amended motion to modify parent-child relationship to enforce the original order and notice of hearing for temporary orders, and that was one document. That was the document that was served. There's actually only one question, and that is whether the proper documents were served on the defendant. Mrs. Moore takes no, the appellee takes no issue with strict compliance, literal and strict compliant. But I would argue that the question of strict compliance is often a matter of context and a matter of detail. Among the cases cited, and Mr. Wide did cite Primate Construction, there was a clear violation, an absolute violation of Section 107B5, in which the defendant was served with a petition that didn't even indicate the defendant was being sued. So that was an absolute if you want strict and literal compliance. In other cases, ZJW failed to note the date and time of service, which is also a requirement of 107 and a violation of 107B, Section 7. Shamrock Oil is another case, and in a similar way, there was a blank space where the name of the petition served. There was no petition served. It was just a blank line. This is one in which there were three plaintiffs and 60 defendants. And in running this stuff off, apparently whoever served the citation just forgot to write the name of the petition, at least in this one. We don't know about the others. And in Houston Welding and Supply, a similar problem occurred where the citation said a true copy of this notice together with accompanying copy of, and it was a blank line. There was no indication of what the petition was. So in the cases cited by appellant in his brief, there were clear and absolute violations of some section of 107. Other cases were also cited, and in those cases, in fact, those are easily distinguished from the cases that show problems. In Herbert v. Greater Gulf Coast Enterprises, the document said a complaint was served. The court found that that was just fine. They called it a complaint rather than a petition, and the Houston court found that citation was compliant and upheld the default judgment. And while the courts do hate default judgments, there are certain times when a default judgment is appropriate. In Ortiz v. Alante, et cetera, the appellant claimed several errors. Wrong petition was named, failed to state the number of copies, the appellant was misnamed. And in that case, the appeals court in Corpus Christi said that it was still sufficient, that there was no strict or literal violation of a section in 107. Silver v. Lavoit, service again was upheld. There was one of the two problems were that the address on the return of service was not the same as the citation form, and the other was that it misnamed the respondent. There was an agent, and there was a misnaming, and the court there, that was the Austin court in a memorandum opinion, found in fact that service was adequate. Williams and Williams, a dispute between a grandmother and a mother over custody, failed to name the petitioner, and the court, I believe it's the Austin court, found that was not important, didn't violate Rule 107. So finally, the question that comes today is more similar, in my opinion, more similar to the latter cases, where the question is what was served. The clerk's form, the citation on the clerk's form that is part of the court's record, shows that the document, it is a form letter, apparently put into a form generator, I'm going to make the wild guess, and the document then is listed as the amended motion to modify parent-child relationship to enforce the original order and the notice of hearing of temporary orders. So the question that comes, the process server then returned the affidavit, and the affidavit said that the documents had been served. The process server had two documents, had the citation, and had, as the court clerk had listed, had a document called the amended motion. So the question becomes whether the process server can call the document by the same name that the citation calls it. The citation refers to a document. The process server referred to the document served. And in that case, the court has to wonder, is that more like the earlier cases where there's a clear violation of 107, or is that more like the latter cases where we have a variance in language that is non-fatal? I think it's fairly clear from the affidavit that the process server served the document. The document is labeled in the clerk's citation. And I think the court can find that, in fact, proper service was had on the defendant. I would also add, as Chief Justice, I believe, pointed out, that there were many opportunities over the course of 18 months, efforts to get information from the respondent, efforts to get discovery, efforts just to find information so we could set a child support number, including services, including a contempt hearing, and we'll get to that. In terms of material change and the pleadings, that's kind of appellant lawyer has kind of fused those two, and I'd like simply to say that there's no argument that two provisions, however, not just one, but two provisions of the Family Code speak to modifications of child support. 156.401 is the one we all know, material and substantial change, or after 3 years if there's been a significant change in income. Also, 156.402 points out the effect of guidelines and allows the court the authority to consider the guidelines and to make adjustments to child support and to enter orders when the child support is not compliant with the guidelines. And that, I believe, is under the court's discretion. The appellant claims that appellee's pleadings do not bring the matter within the court's jurisdiction. And he's arguing, he's trying to apply what I think is an incorrect legal standard, where he points out there's no evidence of financial circumstances having changed. The law does not talk about financial services. The law specifically says, if the circumstances of the child or a person affected have materially and substantially changed. It doesn't say anything about money or finances. One of the cases cited by appellant is an interesting case, CCJ and CMJ, minor children. It's a Dallas case in which the court says the trial court may modify a previous child support order if the circumstances of the child or the person affected have materially and substantially changed since the date of the rendition. Nothing about money, nothing about finances. In determining whether there's been a material and substantial change in circumstances, I'm still quoting the Dallas court in CJJ, it is well settled that the trial court must examine and compare the circumstances of the parents and any minor children at the time of the initial order. The appellant's trying to add language. He's trying to say that it has to be a financial, and in fact, I would argue that there is financial. What I would refer back to, the family law, the code does not define material and substantial change. It defines neither material nor substantial. So I went to Black's Law Dictionary. Material is defined in Black's Law Dictionary as more or less necessary, going to the merits and having to do with matter rather than form. And substantial is simply significant. It is a significant change. Further, the CJJ decision noted the trial court's decision regarding, and it says, we review the evidence in the light most favorable to the order and indulge every presumption in favor of the trial court's ruling if some probative and substantive evidence supports the order, there is no abuse of discretion. And so the trial court has that discretion. In another case, this is AMP, this is a Houston case, in determining whether a modification is important, a trial court should consider the circumstances of the child and the parents at the time of the prior order compared to the circumstances at the time of the trial. Trial courts have broad discretion to determine and modify the amount of child support that a parent must pay. And finally, the court says, if the best interest of the child is the court's primary focus in determining questions of child support. And the trial court, it finally says at 846 in AMP, the trial court may consider other relevant evidence in addition to the factors listed in the guidelines. That is a reference, I think, to 156.402. Putting language in an order and calling it child support does not make it child support language. I would argue, and have argued in the original brief, that the order really did not create any child support obligation. It simply stated that the parents would provide support for the children, and it later said that they would share the expenses of the children. The order was drafted, by the way, by a non-lawyer. She was acting pro se. She was using a form generator she had gotten from a relative. And so she generated this thing over a great deal of dispute with her then husband, who insisted he would not accept a divorce if it included a child support order. So let's consider the evidence that the court did have of material and substantial change. Okay, the appellee's testimony, and this shows in the reporter's record, the first volume, evidence shows that in the prior order, she was married to a man whose gross pay was $45,000 a year. She suddenly became a single parent of three children. And subsequently then, despite the appellant's stated agreement to pay half of the daycare expenses and some other costs along with that, within a few months, appellant ceased paying anything at all for the children's support. Mrs. Moore received no financial support of any kind from the children's father, who did not pay one half of the children's daycare expenses or medical or school or extracurricular, as he had said he would. Reasonably at that point, I think the court could have found that appellant's failure to pay as he had agreed and appellee had expected created a material change in the circumstances. Then, in addition, as further evidence, and as we say, the court needs to have some evidence, and over the 18-month course of the lawsuit, I believe, Justice Sutter, if you pointed this out, The trial court was able to observe and appreciate by the conduct of the appellant that he was not the man he'd promised he would be. Not only did he fail to abide by the very limited agreement to pay that one-half share, he failed to accord any proper respect to the trial court's standing orders to provide income information. He ignored trial court's orders specifically to him to answer discovery. And then finally, when he failed to answer a motion to show cause, he didn't even show up for that. And finally, he was found in contempt, as appellant's lawyer has pointed out, on December 14th, his first appearance. He was found in contempt for his repeated refusal to participate. The trial courts, I'll quote some cases. I still have time. The best interest of the child is always the court's primary consideration in determining questions of child support. The trial court's primary consideration in determining the merits of a request is the best interest of the children, Lynch v. Lynch. Trial court does not abuse its discretion if it bases its decision on conflicting evidence and some evidence supports its opinion. And the Lynch court, again, that's a Supreme Court case, 2002 Supreme Court case, said that here we must decide, and it referred to the mother, we must decide whether Mrs. Lynch presented more than a scintilla of evidence to support the modifying the agreement. Thus, in keeping with Lynch, this court today must decide whether the appellant's complete and utter failure to pay any support for his children, most notably to pay the agreed half, provides more than a scintilla of evidence to support the trial court's finding of a material change. Surely, Mrs. Moore did not suffer great financial hardship, although there was financial hardship, because she was not getting the money she had been promised and was still having to support three children. Without a clear and specific order ordering child support, appellant was not going to pay child support and never would. It's time for the court to step up and do that. She was faced with a material change in her understanding of the children, the father. She needed an order that comported with the guidelines. And Mrs. Moore argues that the appellant's complete failure to live up to his promise and his complete lack of response and respect for the court created enough evidence for the trial court to find that a material change in circumstances since the entry of the original order did exist in the summer of 2013 and certainly in the fall of 2014 when it entered its final default order. I would also argue one of the last arguments that appellant offered was about sufficient evidence to calculate child support. He's not brought that up at this point, but there was in fact his employment contract. There were pay stubs. There was a spreadsheet presented to the court showing the calculations by which his pay stubs were annualized and then divided properly and multiplied by the 0.30, the 30%. And I would point out, since I have time, that Mr. Burke was not arrested on a capias. He was arrested for a traffic stop, and the capias was then reported to him, and he was asked to appear at court. And he didn't show up. There were a couple of those events. And he finally did, when he hired a lawyer, he finally did realize that he needed to show up. So on December 14th, he came and was found in contempt. So I think that gives the court plenty of basis to find that there was material change. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Flynn. Mr. Wide?
May it please the court again. There's an old saying that we all learn in law school that when you have the facts, you argue the facts. When you have law, you argue the law. And when you have neither, you just argue. I think the court is aware of when something is outside the record and when something is within the record. And I'm not going to sit and object if I believe an attorney deviates from what's in the record. Mr. Flynn seems to want the law to apply to Mr. Burke, but he doesn't want the law to apply to his client.
In this court, you're on the wrong side of the Trinity to attack opposing counsel.
I'm not.
We just talk about the law,
yes,
and the facts. We don't talk about people.
The law, if you will, if I may, Justice Daffino, address direct your attention to Mansfield State Bank versus Cohn, literally a 1978 Texas Supreme Court that states, although we liberally construe pro se pleadings and briefs, we hold pro se litigants to the same standards as licensed attorneys and require them to comply with the applicable laws and rules of procedure. So consequently, the decree, if you will, it's completely and wholly irrelevant whether the decree was drafted by an attorney, if you will, at this time, or a pro se litigant. And I will suggest to the court that Mr. Burke has been pro se until we entered into the case also, which I believe the record is clear about. Lastly, in looking at the cases that that the appellee has cited in his brief, the references to Ortiz and Hebert and Silver, if you will, that don't invalidate service. Ironically, Hebert was overruled by Lejeune, if you will, and believe that cite, if you will, for Lejeune is Insurance Company of State versus Lejeune, 297 Southwest 3rd, 254, another Texas Supreme Court 209 decision. And what's happening here is by attempting to pick and, so to speak, say that what the Texas Supreme Court deems as strict and literal compliance is not really strict or literal compliance because somebody received service of process and the document said complaint versus petition. Not having that record before you, I would suggest to you in those cases, the issue is not whether they received service, if you will, of those documents. The issue is whether or not they had, quote unquote, notice of what they were being hauled into court for. And in these types of cases, they are very, very, very fact specific, if you will, because you must go back to, in fact, the affidavit of service or the certificate of service, which is part of the record, to ascertain whether or not strict compliance was followed. I will conclude with, if you will, thanking you for the opportunity to argue again before you, and I will also suggest to you that because the appellee's pleadings in this case and his not only the pleadings, which are part of the record, but also the findings of fact and conclusions of law by the district judge, fail to state any material and substantial change. Ultimately, the subject matter of the trial court was not properly invoked, and therefore any orders issued were in fact void, as you know. With that, I thank you very much, and will yield the rest of my time back to the court.
All right. Thank you so much, Mr. Wide. Mr. Flynn, we appreciate all your briefing in this matter, and we appreciate your arguments this morning here at court. Your case is now submitted, and you all are excused.